Welcome to another Distinct Nostalgia by MIM.
More than a podcast.
A big interview now on Distinct Nostalgia as we meet one of the legends of Coronation Street. He and his on-screen family became firm favourites not long after arriving in 1989. We've already interviewed one of his on-screen sons, and the other one is still in the show. That's when he's not eating weird things in I'm a Celebrity, Get Me Out of Here. We are, of course, talking about Charlie Lawson, who played Jim McDonald. Ashley's been chatting to Charlie about his long career in and out of Coronation Street in this special interview for Distinct Nostalgia.
So another Distinct Nostalgia, and this time I'm delighted that we are welcoming Charlie Lawson. I suppose, really, we have to call you a legend or a legend, don't we, when it comes to Coronation Street, because you're sort of... I know you were there for 11 years, and you came back several times, but... You know, in terms of Coronation Street sort of history, your character's one of the big ones. And they haven't killed you off. You've been back a few times. They've still not killed you off, have they?
No, apparently. Anyway, hello, listeners. How are you doing? Ashley, nice to speak to you, son. Apparently, somebody told me last year that I have the record for the most returns playing the same character in the history of something or other. And that is simply down to the fact that, and you know, we'll touch on it later, no doubt, that when I left 6 months before, well, I had a chat with the then producer and I said, look, the writers are getting bored with me and I'm getting bored with them. And if I stay here, it's a good story and Jim will get killed off. So why don't we just shake hands? And she said, well, give it another 6 months, Charlie. Let's see what we come up with. And I said, well, you know, there's only one Liz McDonald. And quite frankly, Annie Holly, who played Gwen, bless her cotton socks, I said, it's not going to turn out to be a Jim and Liz. It's not going to work. And sure enough, it didn't. But and that wasn't Annie's fault, for God's sake. You know, it was just that they were lost, I think, a bit without that Burton Taylor relationship. Had I stuck to my guns and been an obstreperous arsehole, you know, I think probably he would not be here now to have made, I think it's 7 returns or something ridiculous. So, you know, fair play to them. I'm still on the go and I am aware, talking, well, it's not out of school, it's common knowledge now, but a couple of years ago, Ian saved the character's bacon. Because I think it was felt that it would be a good storyline. You know, you could work a good storyline with Steve, Liz and Jim. And of course, Jim croaks it and Ian kept the character alive. So here I am, Ashley. Who knows? You know, I'll be the last to know. The Sunday Mirror will be telling me or something.
So just remind me, where is he supposed to be now?
Well, as far as I recall, and you'll know this, I'm enjoying very much the classics in the afternoons now. So God knows when I'll catch up with where we are now. But as far as I recall, he left the cemetery with Hannah and off screen, they returned to Australia. I have no idea, mate. They're probably down the road and all at the edge.
That last storyline I thought was a bit bizarre. It all sounded a little bit, you know. Yeah, I know this is what has happened in soap in recent years where storylines become more and more bizarre. But how did you feel about that? It did all seem a little bit far-fetched at times, didn't it?
Well, look, you're being extremely polite. What happened was the 2018 or wherever it was, I was working, I did a series at the BBC. And then after that, straight after that, I did a sort of a travelogue fun programme. And after that, I agreed, Ian Rankin wanted me to play Rebus in the world premiere of Inspector Rebus, his first play. And the first time it was a sort of a three-dimensional Inspector John Rebus. So I met with the producers and the directors and I agreed to play it. Now, meanwhile, the powers that be in Coronation Street had decided that Jim was going to return for a long storyline, which very nice. But as often happens in these cases, it is assumed that you're not working. And it is assumed that even if you are working, you'll drop everything and go and join Curry. And in normal circumstances, if one wasn't working, then, you know, with the storylines I get, then I'd bite their frigging arm off. But I had said that I would do this, and I really wanted to do play Rebus. And so when I informed them, they got very miffed and said, well, have you signed the contract? And I said, no, but I've shaken hands, and the money's very good, and et cetera, et cetera. And unless you come up with something that's really going to tempt me, then obviously my loyalties are with Ian Rankin and Rebus, and that's the way I work. So the storyline that was to be, say, a year was condensed down to 3 months. Now, the premise may have been slightly odd, but and I thought it was definitely not Jim McDonald doing that to Elizabeth, you know. Had we had time to explore the fact, I think the full hit, perhaps Hannah would have had more sway or something. There may have been blackmail or something, but it was condensed right down, and I don't think they were able, it's not the writer's fault, I don't think they were able to explore the possibilities, the full tilt, because I was committed to go and work. So that's what you got. And we did our best, me and, you know, we did our best with what we had. And there were a couple of brilliant scenes in it. I think Love the Graveyard stuff with Liz. And there was a few other bits and pieces that we really enjoyed. And so it was what it was.
And of course, you did the Ian Rankin Rebus, which went all around the country, but you had a bit of a health scare during that period as well, didn't you?
Yeah, just a bit. Yeah, I had a TIA in Edinburgh. I allowed myself, which is very unlike me, I've been doing this 41 years and I'm as tough as old boots. The woman who was going to direct it out of Birmingham Rep, her husband, or she lost her husband about a week before rehearsals started. And so sadly, she had to pull out. And a guy took over, and it became clear from day one that he wouldn't have cast me as Inspector Rebus. Fair enough. And the relationship just got worse from then on. Well, there wasn't a relationship, basically. It was just me getting on. Well, there was 108 pages, and I was in 108 of them. And, and then I stopped sleeping. And you can't take on a part that size when your head's screwed up. It was a massive piece, and I was it, you know. And so opening night in Edinburgh, in the middle of the second half, we were friggin' rocking. The show was roaring, you know. And all of a sudden I went deaf, and everybody turned blue on the stage. And the next thing I remember, I was in the wings, and, Big John Stahl had taken me off. So blah, 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 off to hospital, off to get the scans. You'll have to look this up, Ashley, for God's sake, because it's Latin, you know what medical terms are, right? But it's basically a TIA, which is a mini stroke. And, you know, 20 minutes afterwards, I was fine, but I knew something serious had happened. So I took two shows off and then finished the rest of the tour. And it was an interesting time of my life because it affected me. Not physically in any way at all or mentally, but mentally it affected me. It affected my emotions, and I literally couldn't talk about it without getting upset for about 6 months. And for the first time in my life, I had to be, I went to see my doctor, and she said, right, go and see this person here. They are brilliant for, you know, a counselor effectively, but specifically for what happened to me. And that made the world of difference. And after that, after about a week, I was absolutely fine, and God willing, I'm still here. And I have to take certain pills now for the rest of my life. But I'm fighting fit. I've never been this fit, really, and I'm perfectly normal. Actually, I'm very, very lucky.
But it's, you know, all these things are caused by all sorts of different things, and stress does add to it. I mean, I've been working really hard this year. I was involved in a big 10-part jazz series that we made with Clive Myrie from the BBC, yeah, for Jazz FM. Big thing, a lot of work, lots of hours, lots of very late nights. I've certainly pushed myself this year. And then there was one moment where I suddenly started going weird and delirious back in, I think it was August time. And my partner wondered what the hell was going on and got me into hospital. I was in hospital, sat in a hospital bed. The doctors were talking to me, but I couldn't actually answer them. I knew what they were saying, but I couldn't bring myself to answer them.
And what was that, Ash?
Well, it turned out that I'd had, basically, we didn't know straight away. They were investigating what it was, but I'd got some kind of infection. I'd had a, I'd been away working, doing lots of recording for a Radio 4 documentary in Wales, and I got a bit of sunburn, and also I'd got sunstroke, I think. So that's why my immune system was low. But what had happened was I'm at the bottom end of diabetes. I've got diabetes, but not massively badly. But I'd had an insect wound that had never really healed. And the doctor had said, oh, you don't need to cover it up because it'll heal on its own, which is, I think, was a bad decision. Anyway, what turned out was I ended up in hospital, and within a couple of days, this big scar started emerging, or this big sort of infection on my leg with blisters and boils and all sorts of horrible things. And it turned out that it looks as though the insect bite had sort of, you know. So basically, I ended up with a form of sepsis.
Oh, Jesus, well, you were lucky.
But the point was, I'd been swimming, I'd been, you know, so I'd been keeping myself really active. And it was at that moment where I was at my lowest ebb because I'd been working hard, I got sunstroke, and then suddenly, bang, something hits you, you know what I mean? And it's probably Absolutely. Similar to, for you, you were putting yourself through a lot of stress and tension and things.
Well, mine was, specifically they said, look, Charlie, if you don't sleep, something's going to explode, and you're very, very lucky, because I was on about maybe, and I wasn't drinking or anything. Well, of course I was, but I mean, I wasn't spanking it or anything like that because I couldn't, because I had to get up early in the morning to start early. But I was exhausted mentally and not sleeping. And the more exhausted you get, and mentally exhausted, the less you sleep. And it's just an ever decreasing circle until eventually you just go bang. Unfortunately, I didn't have a stroke. I had a mini stroke.
You have these moments, don't you? And it does make you think about things. It does make you think what's important, doesn't it? That's
yes. And not that I quest. You're more, I've always been pretty, I don't know. I mean, I grew up where I grew up in Northern Ireland, so you're always pretty sanguine about stuff. And you know, I've seen things, and everybody of my age, I'm 61, so we grew up right through the thick of it. And everybody was touched, including me. Everybody was, not just, you know, everybody lost someone and in disgusting, horrible circumstances, no matter what part of the community you were from. We were very, very good at hurting each other. But so it didn't sort of, I didn't sort of sit back and suddenly decide, you know, I am a Christian of sorts, but I didn't suddenly finding myself going to church and thanking the Lord for keeping me alive. I didn't stop drinking, and I've just been normal, but you do, I would say my alarm bells are better. And I certainly appreciate life, but I've always appreciated life. But I care. I'm a lot more aware now of other people's afflictions, and I'm also I'm aware of mental health now that I wasn't before. Although my wife, God rest her soul, Leslie, had a horrible end. She was addicted to prescription drugs and alcohol and had terrible, terrible, terrible depression. And so I had witnessed it, but I had no. It's very hard when someone you love is very ill to, of course, you sympathize, but I've never had a headache in my life, you know what I mean? So I'd never been depressed or anything. So I'm a lot more, since the stroke, I'm a lot more conscious of all that stuff. I would be more conscious about mental health, whereas, you know, when Les, that was a long time ago, and when, you know, Leslie was killed, I shoved all that out of the way. I didn't want to know anything about mental health at all. I wasn't very good. And actually, to be honest with you, you know, I mean, I would be the last person you'd say, right, Charlie, we've got a group of very damaged human beings here. Unless they're soldiers, I work a lot with veterans. Do you know what I mean? Would you go and spend a morning with them? These children have learning difficulties and stuff like that. I would say, you've really got the wrong man here. I would be crap at that. But now I'm far more aware of stuff like that, which is a good thing.
Absolutely. Now, you touched there on your early years and your upbringing and also, you know, basically the Irish side of you. I'm partly Irish, by the way. You can see from my name, Byrne, which is an Irish name. My granddad
I'm Northern Irish, by the way.
I know you are. My granddad was from Carlow. And to sort of, it's all very weird. I've never really got to the bottom of it because he came over in the 30s with the rest of the family. He ended up being in the British. He was in the British Army.
As many fine men from Southern Ireland were. Yeah.
What I don't get. I've never been able to work out why they all came over all at once. Do you know what I mean? I've never managed to get to the bottom of that. And the family's always very quite quiet and secretive about that. So one day, maybe I'll find out. But granddad's gone now.
The history is brilliant. And of course, in those days, people forget that, you know, the Provisional IRA, I mean, there was a war going on for a long time. It was a lot less than the 70s and 80s. But, you know, people in the South, especially if you had served or wanted to serve with the British Army, you weren't very bloody popular, let me tell you. But there's an awful lot of that. I mean, there was an awful lot of Catholics put out in Northern Ireland, and there was an awful lot of Protestants put out of the South. And it's just part of our rich, colourful tapestry that we have to live with. And you know, it's a massive subject and one well worth looking into from either side.
Absolutely. And of course, next year, it's the anniversary of the beginning of the Republic of Ireland. It's 100 years since the Civil War, as it were. So there's a lot of history there. But talking about you and your history and your career. So, you know, let's talk about your career right at the very beginning was in a way shaped, wasn't it, from the fact of where you were based, where you'd grown up, because quite a lot of the things you ended up starring in or acting in were related to the Troubles, weren't they, if I remember rightly?
Yeah, I mean, we back in the day, then it was only, so I'm going back to sort of 1980 when I went to drama school, started there. The Northern Ireland was becoming quite trendy. People were starting to write stuff about it. So, you know, in those days, before you were born probably, mate, there was Play for the Day and Play of the Month.
I was born in 72. So,
oh, well, there you go. Far. So, right. Well, they started to write. Most of them were shite, I have to say. You know what I mean? There was an awful lot of English people sort of going on about the poor wee Republicans and all that sort of carry on. But there was a lot of work around because there was only me, Kieran Hines, Stephen Ray, Dunbar was just starting to creep over the wall, you know. And so there was a bit of work around for us. So you naturally took it. So I would say I turned a lot of stuff down, probably to my cost. I mean, I was asked, Danny Boyle, before he became Danny Boyle, Danny asked me to go to the Royal Court a couple of times, and I wouldn't because the plays were just shit. And they were all about the poor wee bleeding people from the Republic of Ireland. And it was all right for them to kill us and all this fucking carry on. And it used to drive infuriate me. But there was stuff around, and I did do, and it was very useful. I mean, I got my equity card in the first year of drama school, so they very kindly allowed me to go out and do, I think the first thing I did in the BBC was 1981, and that was a screen two called Joyce and June, and I did that. And really, it gave me a good start, you know, and then you ended up doing Harry's Game and blah, 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 and all the usual suspects, really. And we all did very well out of it. And then, of course, the time came, of course, you had to make a fucking decision to start talking like that, doing all that all the time, because you couldn't get a job. Every fucking thing I went for, I had to do all these bollocks, you know, and just con everybody. Otherwise, you wouldn't get any work, you know. So that was it. But it was a long time ago, you know.
You said there was only a few of you around. Did you have a sense that you were, in a way, you were sort of being targeted as like the token Irish people that, you know, could do everything kind of thing? Is that how it felt, or were you sort of, and did that annoy you, or did you just think, oh, bugger, well, I'm going to get the work?
Look,
you
know what I mean? I mean, what you're touching on, it will never go away. I have many, many friends in the industry who are casting directors, and an awful lot of them are very bright, and they can see the potential, you know, they're very good. There are some, however, who don't. And Eamon Holmes will tell you, and he's not an actor, but any actor will tell you that if you're Northern Irish, it is a real struggle because you're immediately worse off than any other actor from the United Kingdom or Great Britain or indeed the Republic of Ireland, because it is such a thing, my dialect and me and being Northern Irish, that some casting directors cannot see beyond that. And that is true. And Tim Healy will tell you the same thing about being a Geordie. I remember Brian Glover saying to me years ago, if you're from Yorkshire, you're allowed to play anything you want. If you're from London, you're allowed to play anything you want. You know, you're up against it, Charlie, because they can't see beyond their nose. Now, there are notable exceptions, and I've done a lot of work playing different things. I'm native Scots, I can do native whatever, blah, blah, and I've had the chance to do that. But it's bloody harder for us than it is for you lot.
No, absolutely. And to be honest, to be fair, when you think about it, for a long period of time, and it's only in recent times, very recent times, that we've ended up with specific programmes on the TV, whether comedy or drama, that cover Northern Ireland. We've got Derry Girls, of course, with Channel 4. But for a long period of time, you will have been the only person on national UK television that most people will know as being somebody from Northern Ireland.
I know, yeah. And that was a real, I have to say, actually, it was a real honour. And I'm writing my autobiography, we'll touch on that in a bit. But I was writing about Mervyn Watson and James Bain, God rest his soul, and Brian Mills. Mervyn was the producer. Now, I was at the National Theatre a couple of years before, and they asked me to join Corrie. And I said no. And I'll tell you why, because I was a po-faced idiot. I was a serious actor at the National Theatre and didn't know anything about Coronation Street and turned it down, as a dozen other actors would have done the same thing, because we were so far up our own arses. Now, of course, actors, never mind Ian McKellen, but an awful lot of actors would kill to be in Corrie, and have done. I mean, you've got Maureen Lipman, God bless her, just, you know, she, you know, so there's this, people are killed to be in Corrie now. But back in the day, Mervyn decided and James decided, right, we're going to have this Northern Irish guy, and saw the consequences. And the poor writers, of course, had absolutely no bloody idea at all. So half my scripts for the first 4 months were all in Mancunian. You know, it was crazy. Hence the Northern Irish bits creeping in. But you are right, and what an honour it was.
Did you have to introduce the, you know, so you will, so I will, so that the Irish phrases? Did you have to introduce?
Yeah,
them?
The Northern Irish stuff came in because you know, there was only, you see, back in the day there was only really Higgins was around still a bit. There was Eamon. There was me. Jimmy Ellis had retired, but I mean, there wasn't many of us around. There was certainly, I mean, Eamon was on the telly saying, so it is, so it was, so blah, 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 and all this lot. And so, I mean, I just decided, we'll give this a crack. So instead of saying, good morning, you know, I would say, what about ye? And of course, the writers were driven nuts because they had no clue what I was on about. But they soon cottoned on to what I was doing and embraced it. And it was a great honour for, I'm very proud of my wee country, as you know, and to be accepted on, you know, we were getting 20 million viewers there some nights in the 90s. And, you know, it was before, there was no phones, no mobile, you know what I mean? People watched the telly. There was only four channels, for fuck's sake. And, you know, so it was a great honour. And I soon learned to enjoy going home more than I ever had, because people were very, very proud, with notable exceptions, I hasten to add, to all my Celtic fans out there. But, you know, I've a great honour to have played the character and still play him. So very, very, very proud. And you're right, I was the only one front and centre.
And so I always remember when I was growing up as a little boy, the only there were several parts of the UK that I only knew certain things. So, for example, Wales, I think the only character I knew from Wales was Fenella the Witch in Chorten and the Wheelies. And the only character, and Ivor the Engine, the cartoon, Ivor the Engine.
Oliver,
and the only character, Yeah, that's right. And the only characters I knew from the Northeast were Jimmy Bolan with When the Boat Comes In, and of course the Likely Lads. You know,
Likely Lads. Yeah.
You know, so it's a thing. You know, people's impressions were often shaped by television. I mean, I met Stephanie Turner and Anna Carter from Juliet Bravo, and I said to both of them, I said, when I was growing up, I didn't know any police women at all. You were the police women that I knew.
Absolutely.
You were, that was it, you know. So it's bizarre. Just before, we'll talk obviously properly about Corrie in a moment, but let's just look at some of those other things that you were in before Corrie. And you're talking about only having four channels. Way back in 1982, we only had four. Well, we just had four channels because Channel 4 had just begun, hadn't it? November 1982.
Like that, yeah.
And you were working at Yorkshire Telly, weren't you, doing Harry's Game?
I've done so much damage to my brain, actually, that I have to check up on this with the old CV. 1982, Harry's Game, Yorkshire Telly, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. So you're working at Yorkshire, which was, of course, a hotbed of creativity, loads of fantastic things made at Yorkshire Television. Tell us a bit about Harry's Game, because you know, it was a big
yeah, it was the first time they'd sort of gone for three consecutive nights, 3 hours of drama and all that sort of stuff, written by Gerald Seymour, who of course was News at 10. He was a journalist, and he'd of course practiced his craft in Northern Ireland, so he was aware of it. It was around about the time several MPs had been murdered, so the premise started from there. It was one of those things. There was a lot of people, and they won't mind me saying this because it's the truth. There were a lot of English guys who were cast as Northern Irish, and some of them just managed to squeak it and others were hopeless. But that's just the way it was in those days. You know, there wasn't enough of us to go around. But it was, for its day, it was brilliant for its day. It wouldn't stand the test of time now. Ray Lonnan was an absolutely darling man. He's dead now, bless him. He played Harry. And of course, Derek Thompson played the hitman. And Derek's from Belfast. Derek doesn't talk like that, you know. Derek talks like that there, so he does. And a great mate of mine, Derek Thompson. And so Derek was brilliant. And then surrounded by a few of us who were from back home. And then a few who tried to get away with it. And some did and some didn't. But look, it was great for the day, and of course Enya had the famous theme tune that went to number one, and it was a roaring success in 1982.
Every now and again, Talking Pictures, I don't know if you've watched Talking Pictures,
yes,
they occasionally bring out some of these old, they're showing a thing at the moment with Margaret Lockwood that Yorkshire TV did in the 70s called Justice.
Wow.
Which is, I never knew Margaret Lockwood was in a TV series. Obviously I think of the films. But
yeah.
Yorkshire were obviously trying to make a big noise right at the beginning because, of course, they came along, you know, and replaced Granada in the Yorkshire area. At some point, I'm sure Harry's Game will probably get repeated on Talking Pictures.
They were a great company to work for, I remember. They paid you handsomely, you know, back in the day. I don't remember what, but I remember thinking, Christ, this is a good wedge. And I thoroughly enjoyed that. And, of course... We couldn't film in Northern Ireland, so we knocked the crap out of parts of Bradford and made them look like bombed out places. I'll never forget, I was writing about this the other day, actually, and there's a scene in it where the British Army raid this Irish club. And so they used this Irish club in Bradford, and unbeknownst to them, you know, in those days, an Irish club in Bradford was a hotbed of republicanism. So they had all these extras in there singing Armored Cars and Tanks and Guns and getting pissed as fucking idiots. And by the time the boys came in as the British Army, by God, it kicked off royal. But no, it was all a good experience and nice to work with. There's some nice stories about that, but I'll tell you about the book later.
Fabulous. And saying on the theme of Ireland, because we said that the Ireland
sort
of was part of your early years and in terms of acting and everything, as well as your life. You did Mike Leigh's TV film 4 Days in July, didn't you, a couple of years later? And that was about the Troubles in Northern Ireland as well. Now, with that, Mike Leigh has a reputation, doesn't he, for making drama in which you set a scenario and you have to work around it as opposed to having a script. Is that right? Was that the same with this one?
Yeah, well, this was when Mike was still pure. I don't know what his sort of whether he's in handcuffs now, but in those days, him and the producer, Ken Trodd, it was literally, we turned up at White City, having done an improvisational audition for him. Then we turned up at White City, about a dozen of us, and we sat in a room, and he said, right, he says, I have no idea what we're going to do, but we're starting in a week's time. And that's where he started. And the basically the brief for me and every other cast member was this: go home and write down the name of anyone you've ever met on the planet, right? Not someone you said hello to, the postman or whatever, but someone of reasonable significance you have met in your years on this planet. And I came back with my list of people that meant something to me, or, you know, were not, and it was a big list. And then you whittle it down, just by talking about the character, whittle it down, and then you settle on one person. And that is essentially where your character starts. And then through a process of improvisation, God almighty, it went on forever. But then you end up with scenes. I ended up with a wife. I ended up being an Ulster Defence Regiment member of the British Army. And while you're not doing it, all the other characters are off doing exactly the same thing with Mike. And then after about 3 months, you've got a script, which you still don't know what it is, but you know what your bits are and who you're working with, but you've no idea what the other character's doing at all. So consequently, it was an extraordinary experience. I learned an awful lot of how to work, and I'm very proud of that. I'm not, however, proud of the finished product. I think I'm crap in it. I think I would have been far better if I'd had 2 weeks, you know what I mean? Because I just don't do anything. I'm not doing anything. But I ended up being, 4 days, and Billy McCracken's the lead in it near enough, you know what I mean? And so it was an extraordinary process, and I learned an awful lot about it. And I've just been writing that. It wasn't until I worked with Gary Oldman many years later. Gary said to him it was his favourite show. He absolutely loved it. And I said, Gary, behave yourself. I thought it was shite. And he said, no, Charlie, that's because you've been in a Mike Leigh piece and you can't see it from the outside because you become so intertwined with it that it doesn't make any sense in the end. You know, and I sort of felt disappointed with it, but I believe it's wonderful. He is a genius, actually. Nobody else works like him.
No.
And we did some extraordinary scenes came out of it. But I'll take away from it this, Mike. Take away this, Mr. Leigh. I learned a great deal from you, and my craft improved immensely. And I learned that being truthful to yourself and the character you're playing is essential. And even if you fall on your arse and you've given an honest performance, that's all you can do, really. And I've tried to do that all through my life, and sometimes it works and sometimes it doesn't. And sometimes it worked in Corrie and other times people didn't like it, you know. But I mean, to go from Mike Leigh to the production line sausage factory of Coronation Street, they couldn't be further apart. Corrie by necessity has to be to a certain degree superficial, because you don't have time to research your blah blah blah. So I tried to make Jim McDonald real and honest, and I had all that from Mike. So fair play to you, Mr. Leigh.
And Ashley's chat with Charlie Lawson for Distinct Nostalgia will continue in just a few minutes.
If nobody was told what you were meant to do, if there weren't any rules, we would be living in a totally different format.
A brand new podcast featuring rarely heard voices from across the UK and around the world.
Bisexuality is not really understood because people have biphobic tendencies.
And the second you mention bisexual, just their ears pick up.
Contemporary conversations around bisexuality.
Oh, well, you're still confused, right? No, I'm not confused.
We are questioned so much more than people when they come out as straight or gay.
It's intense pressure of like, am I sure? You're literally like monitoring yourself.
Every episode will include a very personal story as we try to paint a real picture of bisexual Britain.
This is Bisexual Brunch, available now wherever you get your podcasts.
Distinct drama. fresh and original.
Coming to Distinct Nostalgia this Christmas, a trilogy of comedy dramas by Carl Chetty, starting with Soft Centres.
When I think of how I've wasted my life here.
Starring Sir Derek Jacobi as Frankie.
Placing handmade soft centres and nut clusters into poncy dwarf coffins is hardly an achievement.
And Joanna Lumley as Millicent.
Oh, Frankie's well past this game. He's been here, 30-odd years. He'll be carried out in a box. It's probably a gold chockey box with red bows and ribbons.
And the story continues in Hard Centres.
Well, I'm supposed to be retired, you know, but I'm back in the basement in my own little chockey grotto.
Starring Sir Derek Jacobi as Frankie and Imelda Staunton as Millicent.
I hear I like your new hat, sis.
I'll slap you in a minute, you cheeky runt. You know it is my hat, it's my hair. Sebastian, just done it. Incidentally...
Yes, and what's that dirty look for?
Your senorita's gone, but not forgotten.
My senorita...
What did you do to her? Show her your erogenous zone?
And we conclude with Dark Centres, starring Sir Derek Jacobi as Frankie and June Brown as Millicent.
Is there something going on between you two?
Chance to be a fine thing, but I'm working on it.
Helen Lederer as Mrs. Hamilton.
So he's given someone a box of hard centres instead of soft centres. So what? That's what dentists are for.
And Christopher Ryan as Mr. Hamilton.
Things are already at half-cock. My tinnitus is getting worse, plus I can't sprint for a taxi anymore without wheezing and drawing on my inhaler.
So that's Soft Centres, Hard Centres and Dark Centres by Carl Chetty. Available this Christmas only on Distinct Nostalgia, wherever you get your podcasts.
Coronation Street, then. It was 1989 that the McDonald's arrived with your two kids. And I've spoken to Nick Cochrane about how they were picked and whatever, and he had a bit of a joke about your your reaction to it at the time. Tell us, where did it come from in terms of, you know, how did you, you know, obviously, as you say, they were looking for somebody different, I suppose. But, you know, take us back to the early years. How did it all start for you?
Well, as I say, 2 years before, I'd been a silly boy and said no, really. But that was for a guest role, I guess. And then the phone call came, would I go and see them? So I went to see them, and I read a couple of scenes, and obviously was completely different to anything they'd ever come across. And they wanted a new family to come in and kick a bit of arse. And really, I suppose it was a terribly brave decision on their part, but also a fairly obvious one in the sense that, well, we're not going to get anyone different apart from Charlie, really, are we? You know what I mean? Unless we get a one-legged camel. So, you know, get him in here and let's see what happens. And we were given a 2-year contract, which was unheard of, and it pissed off some of the other cast members, let me tell you, because it was unheard of. And some of the older members of the cast, they would have killed for a 2-year contract. But so there we were, and the lads were only wee boys then, really. And Bev and I, fortunately, gelled very well, and the lads picked up what they picked up pretty damn quick. And we really had to just grab it by the nuts and run with it, because otherwise you get found out pretty damn quick in programs like Coronation Street. And I always say to kids, grab it by the bollocks and stamp your mark on it, because otherwise you'll just get guzzled up and spat out the other end. And even more so now, you know, in those days we had time. We joined, it was only 2 episodes a week, and it was big news going to 3. But we still had rehearsals. We still had time to think about it, you know, and the directors had time to spend time on the actors. It wasn't all about pretty pictures in those days, you know what I mean? It was about the performance.
Absolutely. And there have been several families that have arrived in Corrie and they've gone after about 6 months because it just hasn't worked. They haven't gelled particularly well, you know.
Yeah.
So, I mean, it was quite a... In many ways, just thinking back to that period, you know, it was 1989. Obviously, EastEnders had arrived by that point. But really, you know, Crossroads had just finished. There was Emmerdale. There was Coronation Street. None of those soaps really, you know, we were in a period of time where we'd had the Troubles for a long time in the UK. Very few of the soaps ever touched on anything to do with Northern Ireland or the Troubles or whatever. So this was completely new territory, wasn't it? Bringing in somebody who'd got a Northern Ireland background, the army, all these kind of things in there. So that so the great thing about your character, I suppose, was that from the instant, which isn't always the same with all characters, from the instant you got depth, hadn't you? You got some depth.
Yeah, he had a history. And I think he had too, because although we never touched on the Troubles, so to speak, because it wasn't our territory to do that, he had a history which the writers created. And so there was a depth there, you know what I mean? And there was that they'd been childhood sweethearts and Liz had been dragged all around the bloody planet with the British Army and what have you, that's an important thing that we had straight away that we could build on. And pretty soon the subject was touched upon that, you know, Jim had left the British Army because of his wife and he didn't want to. So you have all this stuff. So we were very lucky, you know, but I think they had to, because it was such a shock for them that all of a sudden there was this Northern Irish guy there, you know what I mean? They just were not expecting it at all. Otherwise, you know, you could tell by the writing, they had no idea that Mervyn and James were going to come up with Charlie Lawson, for God's sake. Can you imagine their wee faces at home? Holy shit, what are we going to do now?
So do you remember meeting everybody for the first time? Do you remember meeting your co-stars for the first time? Do you remember all that?
Yes, I do. We met Bev outside and we went in and sat down and Brian Mosley said, "You can't sit there." And I says, "Why not?" He said, "That's Julie's chair." And I said, "Well, she's not fucking sitting at it now, you know." And so it was all that. It was all very much, it was just sort of the, you know, I suppose the 80s and 90s was its heyday. And there was an awful lot of stuff going on that was frankly very amusing to me and alien to us. You know, I mean, I've written about it, technical runs, people used to put on ball gowns and all sorts of bloody nonsense. I mean, it was just unbelievable. So, and I'd been out in the real world for sort of 10 years and Corey, you know, I don't know what it's like now there, but it's, in those days, you see, celebrity didn't exist. So the top shelf was men only, Mayfair and you know what I mean? And Penthouse. And then below that was Woman's Own and TV Times. That was about it. And then the Dandy and the Beano. Well, you go in there now, it's wall to wall, I'm a celebrity, mow my lawn and blah, 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 and all this. Carry on. We didn't have any of that. There was no mobile phones. There was no iPads. There's not, you know, celebrity was just starting. And Jason and Kylie were, you know what I mean? All it was just kind of starting. And that's why that's why Nick and Simon had, relatively speaking, over the next few years, a very hard time, because they came the biggest stars, young stars on British television. And as I say, when you're getting between 15 and 20 million viewers three nights a week, they found it quite, I know Simon did, and he wouldn't mind me telling you, you know, he found it very hard. And he's still, you know, he's still there. Bless him, you know what I mean? But he very nearly wasn't. He very nearly had enough of it, in the first few years. And I know he did because I was by his side.
Nobody prepares you for that, do they? That's the thing. You can't prepare for becoming a household name, can you, really?
And also, people forget as well. Most of them are all retired now. Most of them, and some of them went to prison. And some of them got done and got fired. But the press in those days were a bunch of shysters. And, no sooner were their mobile phones and they were hacking them and blah, blah. But, I mean, they could really do anything they wanted and nobody prepares that for you. And, I mean, Alison and Janice, the press officers, God bless them both. They would say to you, right, this year is going to change your life. And remember they said to me, Charlie, you've been around some and every skeleton you've got in there is going to come dancing out of the closet. And sure enough, it did. But, but we have a gentler system now, and I'm well aware of you know that I think the young people now, apart from the fact that a lot of them just want to be famous as opposed to be actors, they don't know how easy they get it now, you know.
You joined Coronation Street in 1989 at a time when there were still some people who were in Corrie who'd been there during a period of time, because things were changing a little bit, but Coronation Street was huge. And in a way, some of them, people like, I mean, she'd gone by the time you got there, but people like Pat Phoenix and others, they were massive stars in the sense, in a sort of Hollywood style, weren't they, really?
They were. They were royalty over here, you know what I mean? I mean, I never knew Pat Phoenix at all, but I mean, Julie was right up there. Julie was right up there, let me tell you. And Julie knew she was right up there. I got on like with her like a house on fire because, you know, I wouldn't take any shite off her and vice versa. And so we rubbed along fine. But I mean, you know, as I said, if you'd seen the frocks on a Wednesday afternoon or a Tuesday afternoon or whatever it was, I mean, it was just bizarre. But, it was a different world. It was a totally different world. And as I say, you know, it's hard to imagine four channels. That was it. There were four bloody channels and that was it. So if you were a star in Coronation Street, everybody in Britain knew who you were. Everybody, because not only was there millions of people watching you two or three nights a week, you were in the bloody newspapers every day.
Constantly, yeah. Absolutely.
It was a different world.
Well, let's talk a little bit about how you all sort of shaped the McDonald family. Obviously, you got a script and all the rest of it you had to follow, but presumably you were able to input a little bit here and there into the way things were. You talked about the fact that you got some Northern Irish in there in terms of language and all the rest of it. But, you know, you were dealing with, in terms of the boys, you were dealing with two guys who were very new to it. This is the first thing that they were plucked from obscurity, completely from obscurity, weren't they, really?
Yeah.
You know, they were very new to it. Obviously, they swam very well. But their characters were supposed to be very different. And I think that, you know, it comes over time. But just tell us a bit about how you feel looking back now, how it evolved, and whether there are any things that you felt as though you had to change quickly, or, you know, just tell us a bit about the early years.
I think they got better very, very quickly. They'd done school plays. I think they got better very quickly. I mean, I'm a great believer, and I think Corrie and I suppose Emmerdale and other things, they do find people out damn quick. And I'm a believer that you're either an actor or you're not. I don't believe you can suddenly become one unless you're extremely lucky. I think it's in your genes. God knows why, for Christ's sake. It's very hard to learn how to do. Do you know what I mean? But if you're a natural, you won't get found out. And I think they had it. And it's only, you know, and I mean, Simon will tell you this, you know, I'm not talking out of school, I love the boy. But I mean, there were periods of time when Simon didn't like what he was doing. And I know what periods those are because I've talked to him about it. I'm not going to tell you. You can get Simon to tell you. But, you know, what the initial sort of couple of years, they were young and it all sort of came naturally and it was all boom, boom, boom. It all worked. And then you get a period of time where they're maturing and they start to do acting. You know, and I was always one to say, here, come here, stop acting. You don't have to do that. You know, just do it, for Christ's sake. It's there, it's on the page. Just say the damn thing. Stop acting. But that's something that you have to learn and trust, you know. But they were quite extraordinary, considering the pressure they were under from outside influences and all the, you know, the shit they had to go through with the press and stuff. And Simon, but the nature of the character, you know, his peers weren't that keen on him when he started to become a bit of a wide boy and stuff, you know, so he did have a hard time. But I let Bev do most of the lecturing or whatever, you know, because I thought she would be far more efficient at doing it than me just getting cross. So Bev was very instrumental in there. Because they went through a time where, you know, oh dear, you're late again. And, you know, you're not, you know, I was forever saying, listen, if you can't go out all night and turn up in time, don't be doing it. You know, and because I was very adept at doing that with Philip Middlemas, you know, we were quite adept at staying out all night, but coming in early and being ready to go, you know. But look, I miss Nick not being in it, I felt he was definitely a natural. Nick never had a waiver on the way through, and I often wonder what the hell they got rid of him for. But he was always a natural the whole way through. Simon, I think, had a couple of dips where he found it quite hard. Now, of course, he's a consummate actor. Of course he is, you know. He's so good now that he gets lazy. And don't worry, he's been told, you know, he can give Simon a script and he'll just breeze it, you know what I mean? The trick is to get Simon to do something.
I think you're right about Nick. You know, Andy added something to Steve. And sometimes I look at Steve's character and I think to myself, actually, you know, it'd be great for him to have that contrast of a brother who is very different, sort of giving him a bit of a hard time, pushing him a bit, whatever. And it does feel, yeah, it did. I always liked Andy. And I mean, I was saying to him last time when I spoke to him, you know, for me, it feels very natural. It would be really natural for him to go back into it again, I suppose.
I think he always adds a great deal to the McDonald's. And he was sorely missed. Now, whether or not it's my opinion, Parksy, and it's entirely up to you, Mr. Brian Park, whether you agree with me or not, my friend. Always got on well with Brian, but I think Brian came in and just decided to get rid of a few people. And whether or not he didn't like Nick, I don't know, but I think that's what happened. And I could never understand it.
Producers like to stamp their mark, don't they? They've got to make some kind of...
Yeah. They all do. And it wasn't just Brian. I mean, you know, it happens every few years, you know what I mean? Something happens. Yeah. Unfortunately, what happens then is that the press say you've been fired. Well, I only know of one person in my tenure in all the time I was there who finished before the end of their contract, and they shall remain nameless.
Let's talk about your character. So what were you told that your character, obviously you got the backstory, but in terms of temperament and how he was going to be, I mean, you know, did he evolve or, you know, obviously there were certain things, certain characteristics from the very beginning, but... Yeah, tell us about how Jim McDonald became Jim McDonald.
Well, I think, as I've said, there was an awful lot of time initially, and there was rehearsals, and you know, you had chance to experiment a bit, and I was never the same twice, or tried not to be, and unfortunately, Bev, God bless her, was able to work that way with me because she worked in a completely opposite way. But the writers really, I mean, if you look at all the list of writers that were around then, I see them popping up now. A couple of years ago when that classic Curry started, you know, and the McDonald's appeared, I looked at the writers in there and Jesus Christ, they were shit hot. And they'd been writing Offer Granada, the seat of drama on ITV. They'd been writing stuff, you know, they were really great. But so they allowed us, to answer your question, they allowed us to kick on. And, you know, if something, you know, Jim flew off the handle because I decided he was going to fly off the handle. Now, you know, if you write me a line, there's umpteen ways you can say it. And six times out of 10, if you say it the way that it's not expected, it'll work. So gradually, Bev and I started to spark off each other. And of course, Beverly, you know, we were in each other's pockets and we adored each other. So if I had a crack at Liz, she'd be damn sure she had a crack back in the next line. And so it grew. And so that relationship, though, founded on a deep love and sexual attraction and all that sort of carry on. One was as good as the other, you know what I mean? And that's why they lasted. It was a very strong woman and a very strong man. And it worked. And, of course, the boys, when you're surrounded by that, then the boys just pick up and all that sort of carry on. So we were very lucky. Well done, James Bain, for casting us. You know, it could have been a complete disaster.
Got the, you know, the contrast in the relationship between Jim and Andy and Jim and Steve, you know, the boys were very different and their relationship with their dad was very different, wasn't it, in terms of how they were seen, yeah, and how he saw them. And that's often the case with dads, isn't it? Dads dads will have a son that they're very close to or see as quite important, and other ones that they'll think, oh, he's a waste of space or whatever, you know what I mean? And that that came over, didn't it?
I think it did, and also when the writers got a grip of that, that grew through the 11 years I was there, you know what I mean? It wasn't just once that Steve got his dad in bother or whatever, or vice versa, you know, or his dad got him out of trouble or what have you. You know, it was an ongoing thing. And of course, what can I say, Ashley? I'm very proud of the way we did it. We were very lucky that it worked, because as I say, it could have been a nightmare.
You better mention it, and I was going to wait till the end, but I'll mention it anyway, because you might throw some tidbits from it. You're writing your autobiography at the moment as we speak, are you? You're busy doing it.
Yeah, I'm now up to about, I can see the end, actually. It should be finished in about 2 weeks' time. It's a bit of a monster, but I have a big story. So, it's 200,000 words. I'm doing it. There's no ghostwriter. I'm doing it myself, because contrary to myths, I'm a fairly intelligent human being. I've got some people interested and what have you. So it's all in there.
Fantastic. Have you got a name for it?
No, but you'll probably get fairly close to it, so you will. I want to get it finished first, and then, you know, there's a lot of things happened to me over the years, and so there's a lot of legal stuff to go in.
Of course, yeah.
There's a lot of, I go back, I was at boarding school from the age of six. And it wasn't always, although I was a tough little so-and-so, it wasn't always easy growing up in Belfast. You've got all that stuff then, getting involved in paramilitaries in Scotland, then ending up at drama school, getting my equity card, and then just bashing through. And of course, you get a big CV and you just go through it, and every job's got a story. And I used to wear my heart on the sleeve, so I've got an awful lot of apologising. And, well, you know, I was never out of love until, you know, I was a terrible boy. And I've got all that to go through. And now I'm actually about to start my first return to Coronation Street when he broke out of jail to go to Blackpool. What an idiot.
So let's talk about some of the people, and I'm sure you'll touch on this, some of the characters. Obviously, you got your core family, you all work together. And in a way, I know, as I spoke to other actors before, sometimes it can be fairly lonely, because I don't mean lonely, but you're focused on your family and you don't necessarily always get to see or meet some of the other characters and actors. But you were in Coronation Street in what I would say, certainly the 70s and the 80s, I think, were both periods were very good. There's lots going on. There's some great stars have been there for a long time. Who do you remember? I mean, you mentioned Julie Goodyear. Are there any particular characters, some of the legendary ones that you worked with that, you know, when you look back, you think, you know, that was brilliant to have actually worked with them? Anybody in particular stand out?
I think it was the crack I had with a lot of them. I mean, Mother, as I famously nicknamed her, Lynn Perry, and I had a great laugh. And I ended up looking after her, bless her, towards her end in the show. I used to play golf with Briggsy. Philip Middlemas and I were inseparable, and we did Manchester. God, I couldn't even begin to tell you what we did in Manchester. Well, you can read the book, but and I was fortunate. Sarah Lancashire and I were extremely close, and we were very close, and I don't mean that in any sort of sexual way, but we were very close, and had circumstances been different, who knows. Eva Pope is still one of my dearest friends, and actually went on to virtually save my life in latter years. That's another story, but Eva, I was speaking to her earlier on today. So it was really, I didn't find any of them sort of intimidating, because I'd been around and I didn't watch the street. So I, you know, although I knew who they were, I didn't, and they were massive. There is no doubt about that. But I got on. I mean, there were a couple of, listen, Somebody famously said, used to make me laugh, and I'm not going to tell you who, so used to say endlessly, if you stab one of us, we all bleed. And I used to go, yeah, right. You know, there were 40 egos in there, and let me tell you, some of them were bloody monsters. And there was an awful lot of people getting shot upstairs and all that. You know, it wasn't all bloody roses, you know, but it says an awful lot that everybody pulled together and produced the program at the end of the week. Because it wasn't all wine and roses. It was all wine, but there, you know, some of the roses were very damaged and some of them got ripped up and thrown out, let me tell you. And anybody who's been in the other one, EastEnders or Emmerdale, will tell you exactly the same thing, if they're being honest. You know, there are an awful lot of egos.
Yeah, I mean, there's going to be, isn't there? It's human nature in that sense, you know.
You get 40 actors together, you know, it ain't going to all be wine and roses. It's the same as you've got an industry. You work in the bloody industry as well, actually. You know damn well. Full of egos.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, there is one character that I am fascinated by, one actress that I'm fascinated by, and we have heard various people's stories about her. Chris Quinton talks about her and various other people if you listen through the Stink Nostalgia interviews, and it's fascinating because she's not around to talk to us, sadly, and she was in so many other things other than Coronation Street. You know, she was in Kes and all sorts of kitchen sink dramas and all the rest of it.
Lynn.
And that is, you just mentioned Lynn Perry. I'm fascinated by Lynn because I know that she was a real character on and off screen. Tell us about Lynn Perry. Just tell us some interesting things about Lynn. Can you remember first meeting her?
First day I went to the Boozer with Johnny Briggs and Lynn, and she was getting stuck into the brandy and baby sham, and Briggsy was, you know, and I was getting stuck into the pints, and Lynn was a great actress. She hadn't done perhaps as much as she thinks she had, but she was a good actress. She was great fun. But she rattled a bit. I mean, there was a funny story about me and Kev Kennedy, because Kev was a great mate of mine, and he won't mind me telling you this. And I mean, Lynn used to have a cocktail of pills that she was on all the bloody time, and she shared some out with us one day, and by God, we were all over the bloody shop, you know what I mean? But Lynn was her own worst enemy, bless her, you know what I mean? She did let, there is no doubt about it, you know, it's the truth, so I'm not treading on any toes. She just let the drink get the better of her, and but she was great crack, so she was. And I remember I used to go to the Greyhounds with her at Bellevue, and she used to, me and Philip and Lynn took her to the Hacienda, for Christ's sake, you know. She was value for money, so she was, and unfortunately in the end she just lost it a wee bit, and why on earth she had cosmetic surgery, God only knows. But I mean, it was a sad demise, bless her, because there's no doubt about it, she was one of the stalwart characters. And when she was on song, when she was firing on all cylinders, she was absolutely bloody great, you know. As all of them were in their own different ways.
I grew up in Yorkshire, and my partner did as well, and we all knew, to be fair, when I was growing up, an Ivy Tilsley. There was an Ivy everywhere. You know, she'd got that. I mean, she was from Yorkshire as well, and Olin Perry. She got that to a T. She was fantastic at that. And you know, she just felt real. There's something real about her. And I love the way in which she'd, you know, in the early years, she had this, which was brave of Corrie in a way, because, you know, you didn't always tackle, Soaps didn't always tackle religion and things like that. And she had this she had this thing with the Catholicism and all the various things going on in her head. And, you know, actually, you know, most people would look at her and think, oh, you're daft, you're stupid, whatever. But you had some sympathy for her because she could see how much she believed in what she believed in.
Yeah, she did. Look, they don't build them like Lynn anymore, you know what I mean? I had a great fun with her. I very seldom worked with her on the set. But that's often the case. I mean, I probably only had about four or five scenes with William over the years. That's just the way it goes, you know what I mean? But I'm full of admiration for them all, and I touched on that just there. I mean, William Roach is a... Put it this way, I have absolutely no idea why that man has not been knighted. I just don't get it. And maybe maybe it's because you have to be nominated or something, in which case I nominate William Roach. He's an absolute gentleman. I always got on with him. He always called me Charles, and I always called him William. And we were the only two people who did, because he hated Bill. Probably still does. But, you know, he's still turning it out, you know?
But he has got an MBE.
Yeah, but he should have a bloody knighthood. You know, I can look around, Ashley, and you can look around and look at some of the arseholes who've been knighted. And, you know, I don't have to say who they are, but you can name at least 10 in 5 seconds, and me, but I'm not going to. But, I mean, and you look at, you know, I was able to, Billy Tarmey was a very, very good friend of mine, and I stayed with him very often when I was in trouble. And, you know, Billy was great fun. And, I mean, but there you go. I mean, you know, Liz Dawn and I didn't get on, you know, so we didn't, you know, so there was no point in going for a picnic, for Christ's sake. We just sort of went like that, you know. But that's the way of the world. But she didn't get on with Lynn either. Everybody was very strong in their own way. And that's a very hard recipe to get right. And at one point in the 80s, every single person on that show was strong and good. There wasn't any waste of space there. No. You know what I mean? It was, you know.
I like the character relationship between Jim and Maud. When you were in a wheelchair for a while, and of course she was in a wheelchair. Yeah. Yeah. That was classic. That was really good. I only discovered,
well, you know what I'm like from today. I only discovered YouTube about 2 years ago, and I found clips on there. Jesus, I'm all over the bloody thing, which is brilliant. And I found those clips, those scenes. And of course, in those days, you know, there was still a wee bit more time. And those scenes with Jim and Maud, they would be in my top 10 of things I've ever done. They're just brilliant. Because the writing is, you know, you don't have to say much when you've got Jim crying and Maud saying, what do you mean you're going to kill yourself? I thought you were a soldier, you know, blah, blah, and all this sort of stuff. It's just superb. And so I remember I was saying in the book, I can't remember which scene it was, but we finished one scene and Liz Bradley just turned around to the director and said, well, you won't get any better than that. And he looked at us and he said, print it, you know.
Absolutely. Apparently, according to I interviewed Sherry Houston, Sherry was saying that in real life, she was a bit of a party animal.
She was. Actress. She did. She liked to drink. I used to knock about with her when I first joined the street. There was early, I used to stay in the Midlands sometimes, and Amanda was staying there, and Liz Bradley used to go up there, and she, oh no, she'd be there after dinner, don't be, you know, she wouldn't be first to bed, you know.
Great. Well, and of course, and Amanda was still in it, wasn't she, when you started?
She was.
And obviously brilliant actress and done lots and lots of things. I mean, she's another one, really, when you think about it, in terms of the amount of things she's done. But you're right. I mean, there's been some real characters in Corrie. How do you feel when you're looking back at these episodes that you've been watching on Classic Corrie, which I've been doing as well? And it's a real comfort blanket to watch them, actually. I sit there with a cup of tea and a biscuit, and it's really nice in the afternoons. What is it about them, do you think, that is? I mean, I think it's about the writing and the language and the, you know, the fact that it's not, I mean, you know, we know things have moved on. We know there's action and stuff in all these programmes now, and more of that than there is of the words. But do you think that's regrettable? Do you think the fact that there isn't a focus on the words as much as there used to be?
Yeah, I mean, look, good acting is about people talking to each other. It's the spoken word. That's why radio is the finest media there is. It's as simple as that. It's the purest and finest. Two actors talking to each other. You don't need to shoot pretty pictures. You want two actors talking to each other. That's what it's all about. And we still had a lot of that in the 80s. And we all know, as you say, actually, things have to change in the 90s. And we've moved on. We're in 2021, for God's sake. And, you know, it's all different. But in those days, characters talked to each other. They shouted at each other. They cried with each other. And the dialogue was the most important thing in the performance. And nobody was bothered about pretty pictures and stuff. And we all know it's moved on. But the standard, I think, of the programmes that we watch in the afternoons now would take some beating. You know, it's very rare now that you would ever, unless it's specifically written, you would get a scene you know, 4 minutes long or something. It doesn't sound like a long time, but you count it out, it's a long time. And the McDonald's had scenes like that, you know, and people had scenes like that. And it's very hard now when you've got 70 people and 6 episodes to do a week, you know, or you've got 100 people. So there are different, if you're asking me, do I think it was better in the 80s and 90s? I would have to say yes. And that's not the cast's fault. It's because we had more time, we had more opportunity, and we had less people in the show. And there was more time for characters to relate to each other. You know, some people would say that it's better now. I believe over the last few days it's been very exciting. I don't know, because I'm usually in the pub at 7:30 or whatever. But as you say, Ashley, things move on. It's like my favorite film, 12 Angry Men. Well, it wouldn't look the same if you made it now, but the black and white version of 12 Angry Men, when you get 12 jurors sitting around a room and the film takes an hour and 40 minutes and it's 12 good men and true talking to each other. That's all it is.
And things are also cyclical as well. You know, I find in our industry that people have mantras that they're always trying. Oh, this is the best thing. This is what's the new thing. And everyone's going to follow it, blah, blah, blah. You know, I work in radio and in TV to an extent. And the last 20 years, there's not one conference I've been to where people haven't been writing off the demise of radio and television. And you know what? It's still there. They're still doing very well. Viewing figures are actually pretty good, really, to say when you think there's actually lots of choice out there. You know, ITV is still pulling in big viewing figures for its programmes, et cetera, et cetera. And, you know, there's always people trying to write things off. But also I think things are cyclical as well, because, you know, we're doing a podcast. And I hate the word podcast. It's such a technical word. At the end of the day, we're doing a show, aren't we? But what you find out with podcasts is that actually the ones that are most successful tend to be the ones that are actually quite long. The people who people like to invest time in them. So actually this nonsense that people have got very tiny short attention spans isn't necessarily the case for everything, you know. So it might be that we go full circle, you know.
Yeah, I mean, as you've just said there, radio, the spoken voice is the most powerful thing in our artistic world, in my opinion. I mean, there's a video going on around on Twitter of your man doing Only Milk Wood at the National. Have you seen it? He's a Welsh actor, and his name escapes me. You'll know him, but he Google it anyway. He's doing it at the National, and that's about. He's reading Dylan Thomas. He's not reading it. He's performing under Milk Wood. He's speaking the verse, speaking the prose. And that's all it is. You don't need anything else. If it's well written, the prose is well written, the actors, you can't do shite. It's very hard to do rubbish. You know, it gets found out. Bad writing gets found out. When it's good writing, and we had brilliant writing in the 90s, and you've got a bit of time, and you're a half decent actor, and all you do is put a camera on you and a camera on me and put a few cuts in there and the odd close-up for 5 minutes, and you can't whack it. And there's no explosions, you know. But look, we live in different times, actually, for God's sake, you know.
As I say, I think it's all cyclical and things evolve. And, you know, in another 10 years' time, everyone will be saying, oh, those healing comedies, we need to celebrate them again because they were brilliant. You get that, don't you? So I want to talk to you about some of the other things that you've done in a minute. But with regards to Corrie, you know, you had some fantastic storylines over the years. And obviously that chemistry that you had with Bev and the, you know, there was something, it's obviously a drama, a soap opera or whatever, but there was something real about those characters. You felt as though, and this is obviously the sign of anything that's successful, people were watching your characters twice a week, three times a week, whatever. They felt as though they knew you, because there was some kind of realism about those characters. You felt as though you knew a Jim and a Liz in real life, that they existed in some respects. And the thing I liked about it was, you know, my dad won't have a problem with me saying this because we've talked about it at length. But, you know, I grew up in a household where mum and dad, when I was growing up, were always rowing. You know, I was sat at the top of the stairs listening to them rowing quite late at night and all the rest of it. It never impacted on me, you know, directly, but it did impact on me in the sense I heard them, you know, arguing all the time. And that is the reality of our lives, isn't it? People's lives are not perfect. Relationships aren't perfect. Sometimes people stay together for years and years and years, but their relationship is tumultuous and there's lots going on. And that's what I liked about it. And I think that's what was the attraction.
People, and people, you know, Jim and Liz used to shout at Steve and Andy. Well, that's what bloody happens, for Christ's sake. You know what I mean? With your two young lads living in the same house, in number 11. That's what bloody happens. They get on your wick and that's what happens. And they're always, you know, oh, he's drinking again. They said, well, what's it got to do with you? Piss off. You know, I mean, that's what happens. And of course, you always knew that that Jim and Liz, really wanted each other, and it was proved over the years that they had a thing for each other, and they always will. I mean, you know, that's just the way it is. And although, you know, there came points and when they split up, you know, for Christ's sake, they get married in jail. You know what I mean? So look, I was blessed to do that. I'm very proud of it, actually, and I'm glad that you and other people enjoyed it. Because Bev and I wouldn't have hung around if we hadn't enjoyed it either. Life's too short.
And Ashley's chat with Charlie Lawson will continue in just a few minutes.
As well as amazing interviews just like the one you're listening to now, the Distinct Nostalgia podcast is also home to an epic radio quiz.
Oh, I've never heard of it.
Where listeners just like you go head-to-head on their favourite TV shows and films and put their general knowledge to the test.
There's a bonus point if you can sing the theme tune, but I know you're not going to, are you?
Skippy, 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 the bush kangaroo is all I can remember
that. Yeah, that earns you a point. Yeah, I'll go for that.
A brand new season of the Distinct Nostalgia Mind of the Month quiz is almost here. And it needs you.
Prisoner cell block.
Cell block B.
Prisoner cell block H.
Simply pick your favourite TV show or film and get in touch at distinctnostalgia.com or by messaging us on Twitter.
Have a go at three British films. Just have a guess.
Oh, Whistle Down the Wind, Carry On Up the Khyber. No, this is rubbish. I'm sorry. No, I don't know.
They're not bad attempts, actually.
And the two leading minds from across the month compete head-to-head in the final for a coveted Distinct Nostalgia mug.
It's almost like a trophy.
The Distinct Nostalgia Mind of the Month quiz.
Got there in the end.
Oh, that's amazing.
They always are.
If you're a Blue Peter fan, you'll enjoy something special we've got coming soon. Tim Vincent is going in search of Valerie Singleton, and he'll be meeting one or two others along the way.
Hi, Peter. It's Tim Vincent. How are you?
Oh, hi, Tim. How are you? Nice to hear from you.
I'm not too bad. I tell you why I'm ringing up. I'm trying to get hold of Valerie's number, by any chance.
What, Singleton?
Yes.
I'm not sure I've got her now. I've got an address somewhere.
Well, I'm tempted to ask, why do you want Val's phone number, Tim? I'll only pass it on to you if you divulge why you want it.
Tim Vincent, as I live and breathe. What are you calling me for? What do you want?
Hello? Tim?
Tim Vincent.
Tim Vincent. Oh, God. It's Tim. Just say it's about 20 minutes or something.
No, that's Tim Vincent from Blue Peter.
Listen out for In Search of Valerie Singleton with Tim Vincent very soon on Distinct Nostalgia.
Let's just talk a little bit about some of the other things you did. Now, I didn't know this, probably because I did watch it a bit, but maybe I don't remember it too well. But you were in 11 episodes of Bread. Is that right?
Yeah. Well, I went up for Joey, completely stupid, but I went in and I bullshitted my way in. And the way out the door, I started speaking Northern Irish again. And Carla called me back in with Robin Nash, the producer, and said, I can't believe you've just bullshitted us. I said, well, I'm an actor. That's what I do. You know what I mean? And so she said, well, if you let me, I'm going to write a part for you into a couple of episodes into every series. And I said, well, you're a darling woman, Carla. I'm your man. So there it was. Simon Royce and I turned up and guested a couple of episodes in five series or whatever it was. And it was a long time ago, but great fun. And incidentally, that was, I don't think you'd get away with it now, but Pete Howitt, me, and Vic McGuire and Simon Rouse, who you'll know from The Bill, and multitude of other things, we were impossible. The scenes ground to a halt, and in the end, word would come down on from on high, from BBC White City up to Liverpool, saying, stop it, stop it right now, or you will be sent off, red carded, the lot of you, because if we started, that was it. The whole day was ended. We just couldn't. I mean, I've worked with Mike Elphick over the years, and there's been drink taken, and God knows. But this was just laughter. Once we started, that was it. We were very, very badly behaved. But we produced it.
He introduced you as a sort of semi-regular, incidental kind of character, was it?
Yeah, that was Carla. Yeah, she just said, because I'd had the balls to go in and pretend to be Joey, you know, pretend to be a Scouser and all this stuff. When I went out, I just said, all right, all the best then. Thanks for seeing me. And she said, get your arse back in here. She said, I can't believe you've done that, you know. I mean, I was totally wrong for it. You know, Pete Howitt was right. But, so that was it. But in those days, the world was different in my business. The world was different. Yeah, who would have thought that? Well, I'm going to write that bastard apart. Because he's had the balls that, you know, it's all different now. It's all changed now.
Carla is sort of, in a way, I mean, she's did some fantastic things, but in a way, she's been uncelebrated a bit, hasn't she? In the sense of, you know, she did some brilliant things, but sometimes I think she's overlooked when actually she was pushing against the tide, you know, at the time, you know, there wasn't many women writing comedy, was there?
Yeah,
you know, she wrote comedy after comedy, you know, Live of Birds, Bread, you know, all sorts of things over the years, you know, and I think she was a brilliant writer, you know.
But they put it on now, you see, actually, that, you know, I can't even spell political correctness, but you see, it's all changed now. Yeah. And, you know, and they don't want a matriarch running a family. It's not funny. It would be considered politically inept and politically incorrect, and people would be insulted by Aveline. People would be insulted by, you know, the comedy, and it's so sad. And I hope that this is cyclical, and I hope that in 10 years' time, British humour is not. I don't need some buck agent telling me in the afternoon what is about to come on was written in the 1970s, and it might bloody offend you. I mean, in the name of Jesus.
I saw one the other night. It said it was a World War II thing. Well, World War I thing. It said, oh, it was Upstairs, Downstairs. That's what it was. On Talking Pictures, it said, this drama was made in the 1970s and is about World War I and includes attitudes and blah, 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 blah from the First World War. Well, of course it does. It was about the First World War, for God's sake. You know, it's not ridiculous.
Yeah, it's like saying Shakespeare's Othello. They mentioned making the Beast of Two Backs. Please cut it out.
Yeah, I agree.
I despair, and that's why I turned to Talking Pictures, and that's why, unfortunately, that I really haven't watched the BBC for a long time now, and that's really sad because I loved Auntie Babe, you know.
What Carla was good at the end of the day, her raison d'etre was observational comedy, wasn't it? She observed how people were. It wasn't sanitized how people are. It was about how the characters that exist in real life. That's what she was observing, and that's what came over, and that's why we you know, love or hate those characters. We sort of identify with them because people were out there like that. That's the point.
Of course. And I mean, why do you think that the funniest man that's ever walked the planet is Billy Connolly? Because it's observational comedy. It's about real people. Now, you might find him offensive, but, you know, I mean, as Billy would say to you know, he wouldn't even get on the TV now, you know what I mean? But that's just, God willing, it's cyclical, as you say, Ash, and that we'll get back to normality fairly soon, but that look, it might be not
might
right
take a
to
while.
Say,
yeah, I mean, you're getting to a point now in certain programs, where they become like infomercials. They become like, you know, sort of public service information films. So you'll get a storyline in some drama about a particular issue, and then you'll hear lots of little words that are mentioned that you feel as though have come from an advice leaflet or something. Do you know what I mean?
It's not true. Tell me it is not true that Coronation Street are now dealing with frigging climate change. Is this true?
All of them are. All of the soaps are doing climate change. All of them. Yeah.
You imagine Jim McDonald and Liz talking about fucking climate change.
I know. It's shoehorning it in, isn't it? Shoehorning it in. I mean, you probably would have got away. You would have got it, of course, if Spider and Emily were still in it.
That would have been something.
But it has to be about the character, doesn't it? That's the point. Yeah. It has to be related to the character, you know.
Yeah, bless her. I mean, I'd love to see Eileen come back, Eileen Derbyshire. She's a great character. I tell you what, she had some sense of humour, so she did.
Yeah, Martin was saying that. Martin said she was tremendous fun to play alongside as Spider. That, you know, he had a real laugh with her all the time, you know. But you were also in another soap opera that's still with us in the afternoons. You're apparently in 24 episodes of Doctors. What's all that about? I don't remember that.
Well, that's wrong for a start. I did a year there, I think.
Oh, really?
Yeah. I did. What was that all about? They offered me a job. They said, fair play to the casting director. They said, would you come down and play a surgeon? How do you fancy that? And I said, of course I do. I've never played a surgeon. That'd be lovely. And why? Northern Irish surgeons. Grew up in the 70s, finest surgeons in the world, for God's sake. If you were going to be in a car crash, you wanted that happen at the Royal Victoria Hospital next door to you, because they put people together again. And then, of course, I was to have an affair with the lovely, lovely good friend of mine, Natalie Robb, who plays somebody in Emmerdale Farm. And I'm ashamed to say I don't know, but... So the beautiful Natalie was to play Bill's lover. So I couldn't think of a better way to spend 8 months or whatever it was. So off I went. And, of course, living in Cheshire, it was an easy commute. And so most enjoyable, so it was.
Plays Moira Barton in Emmerdale.
There you go.
But before that, she was in Take the High Road many years ago.
Many moons ago.
The Scottish soap opera. So, yeah, so you enjoyed your time on Doctors then, yeah?
Yeah, it was money for old rope, mate. You know what I mean? You just went down and, you know, churned it out, and it's not earth-shattering stuff, but, you know, it was a nice where I just met Debbie and was starting to go out with Debbie, so a year's income was very nice. Thank you very much. You know, I mean, we're all actors, you know. We all need to earn banana. That's why the last 2 years have been so much rubbish.
Did you end up playing an Irishman, or were you having to do a London accent?
No, it was a very sort of gentle, very sort of quite posh Northern Irish, quite quiet Northern Irish. So I just thought, well, there's no reason why I shouldn't be Northern Irish. We've got the best surgeons in the world. I'm now of the belief that it's very hard to be cast as anyone different nowadays anyway, you know. But I was quite happy to play a Northern Irish surgeon. More than happy, as I did, and I played a detective in Deep, a special we did. Why can't the undercover cop or the undercover guy detective? Why can't he be Northern Irish, for God's sake? They're the best police in the world.
You were a surgeon in Doctors, yeah?
Yeah.
And what were you in The Bill then? What did you play in The Bill?
Oh, I've done The Bill about three times. I've played a copper, undercover copper once, an ordinary copper. The second time, and then strangely enough, the third time, I kidnapped somebody. But you know, talking about the industry, the first time I did The Bill was around about 1989. And do you know what? They were looking for a new permanent character. So, by way of auditioning, they didn't have you down for an interview. They said, Charlie, come in and do these two episodes. And if we like the character, you're in. Isn't that good? It's a different world. Instead of saying, let's do an interview, said, no, let's write a fucking part and let's get Charlie down to play it. And if it works, so be it. We'll get him in as an undercover XRUC guy who obviously has to leave Northern Ireland, comes and works in The Bill. And do you know what? About 3 weeks later, I got the part as a permanent member to join The Bill. And then about 2 days later, Corey came for me. And I had to sit there and say, oh, God.
So, yeah, so, I mean, yeah, you've been in all sorts of things over the years. And obviously the thing, I mean, I'm going to say that Corrie, in a way, put you on the map in the sense of made you a household name. But you had done other things that were big. Harry's Game was big. You know, all these things were big things. And you could have probably carried on and done lots of big things like that. Just reflect on how Coronation Street sort of pushed you in one particular direction. And are you happy about that when you look back, or would you have liked those years to have been more varied? How do you think about it?
I kind of look at it the way that I had a good time for 10 years. Last year wasn't ideal, but life's too short really to look. Hindsight's a pain in the arse. You know what I mean? I had a good character and I played the character well, I think. And I enjoyed 10 out of those 11 years. And then I enjoyed the sort of 7 or 8 times I've been back. It's infinitely nicer being famous than not famous. You know, and while there are things that perhaps, I mean, you know, I wouldn't have got to play Frank in Educating Rita. Lots of other things I've done that I wouldn't have done. I wouldn't have, you know, I guest starred in lots of Dale and Pascoe's and blah, 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 lots of different things because A, I'm good, but B, I was a name, you know, and in a respectable production. So I wouldn't have got John Rebus, for God's sake. You know what I mean? You know, there's bums on seats. People aren't stupid. You know, they get Charlie Lawson. Well, it's going to help sell tickets for Inspector Rebus. You know, that's just the way it is. So I don't have any regrets at all, you know, and I've got an awful lot of free tickets out of it. I've got an awful lot of games of golf. I've been racing, horse racing all over the bloody place because of it. I've been to the Maldi, blah, 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 blah. You know, it's infinitely nicer being famous than not, you know, for me anyway. And by and large, the press leave me alone because they know I'll give them a slap if they don't.
And I don't think, you know, often I talk about this on these interviews about people being typecast and, you know, some stars have been quite sort of emotional, actually, about how a programme completely changed them and meant that because of the character, they weren't able to go and do other things and all the rest of it. I don't think, if I'm being honest, thinking about you and the kind of parts you've played, I don't think you have been typecast, actually. You've done a fair range of things, haven't you?
Well, I've been lucky. I mean, I played a gay hotelier in something I've done, you know. But listen, I am now 61, mate, and I was famous. I was in The Firm and all sorts of stuff years ago. I'm too old to be going around whacking people now. You know, I get that, for God's sake. Not that I'm not capable of blah, 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 but, you know, times move on now, so different parts come along, you know, and I can't even remember the name of the thing I was going to do after Rebus. But then I started a new agency, the Markham agency in London, and this bloody nonsense arrived, COVID, you know. And for an awful lot of people, it's been very difficult. And it's been difficult for me. I mean, you know, I haven't worked for 4 months, you know. And it's same with everybody, but it's hard. But look, I am not going to be cast. Why would you cast Charlie Lawson as something that he's not remotely? I mean, you know, I can play stuff, but the reason why I played the gay hotelier was because it's bums on seats. Let's get, you know, a face in to play this. He can do it. He's a bloody actor, for Christ's sake. He doesn't have to camp about like John Inman, for Christ's sake, you know. So opportunities are there, and I've been very lucky to have them. And long may it continue. I've no intention to bloody retire, and I can't afford to.
And talking about horses, you've got a lovely picture of horses behind you. Are they particular horses, or are they fictional horses? Yeah,
that's Desert Orchid, Arkle, and Red Rum. And
it's called
We Three Kings. It's called, and then there's my three dogs there up when we were fishing. Yeah, I mean, you know, I wouldn't have got to go fly fishing on the River Tay, for Christ's sake, £1,000 a day for nothing. You know what I mean? So it's infinitely nicer being famous than not, and even a legend.
Now, the one thing I'd like when it comes back to Jim McDonald and Corrie is it would be nice for the characters, as in the family as a family, to reappear at some point. whatever happens to them, I don't know. But it would be, you know, what's annoyed me when you've come back or Nick's come back a couple of times or whatever, is we've not seen the four of them together for such a long time. And I feel as though some kind of reuniting. I know that Liz's character's gone now. Bev's gone, and I don't know whether she would come back or not. But it would be nice for them to reunite at some point. I mean, do you think that, A, do you think that's on the cards? And B, would you like that to happen?
I would love it to happen. My gut instinct is that in these days that we live in now, actually, I think it would be very hard, and it's not a criticism, I'm just not sure the writers would know what to do with Jim McDonald. I think the ambience of the show has changed completely. I'm not sure they would know what to do with him. He's an old beast from a different age. His conception of political correctness would be non-existent. You know, I'm not sure how he would fit into to Corey. I think the only way he would come back would be, I'm guessing, would be on a short term with Steve in trouble or something like that. I would love for them all to come back together. Of course I wouldn't. I'd love to work with Bev again. If you're asking me, I would honestly say that the next time may be the last, because I think, if you're going to bring him back, you want to bring him back. There's only one of two ways. Well, there's only two ways he can come back, and he can be the Jim of old. Is that going to fit? Is that going to fit with whatever? I'd love it, or is he going to come back and the storyline is going to be his demise? Now, I say that simply because I know that that was a plan a couple of years ago and Ian stuck up for me. He's a good guy, actually. It's very, very rare you have a relationship with a producer you're not working with, but I speak to him once a year. So I would love it to happen, but I don't think it will. I'm not sure where you'd put him in the street, which is sad.
Looking back, you're very proud, I'm sure, to have played one of the major characters, because you were a major character of Coronation Street in its history, definitely.
Yeah, desperately proud of it. 11 years and then back 7 or 8 times. Very few of us get a chance to do that in our industry. Take it from me. So, thanks everybody for watching me. And I can't thank yous enough for the support I've had through the Rebus thing and all the nice stuff that goes on social media. Thank you very much to everybody.
Reading it all in your book when it comes out eventually.
Yes, you'll know about it.
I'm sure we will. Thank you very much indeed, Charlie, for talking to us. It's been lovely. Thank you.
Been a pleasure, mate. Been a pleasure.
Charlie Lawson talking to Ashley, and Charlie's not the only street legend we're hearing from over the festive period here on Distinct Nostalgia. Up next is Sean Wilson, who played Martin Platt for many years.
Bill Roach sat down there, and Julie Goodyear and Gene Alexander and Betty Driver and Barbara Knox. You just go on and on and on, and they're all there in front of you, all drinking coffee. But it's a lovely, friendly arm that comes around anybody new, because and I always kept to this myself. Thelma Barlow said to me, "Sean, we've all been you. We know how it feels."
And don't forget, there's a treasure trove of interviews on Distinct Nostalgia for you to enjoy at any time. Nearly 200 hours of reunions and interviews, as well as original drama and comedy. Not to mention our big Distinct Nostalgia Mind of the Month quiz. Just look up Distinct Nostalgia wherever you get your podcasts and search through our archive. Distinct Nostalgia is produced by MIM, and if you like what we do, then please consider supporting us on Patreon. Every penny helps us to make even more amazing content just for you. Go to distinctnostalgia.com and click on the donate button. Thank you.
Distinct Nostalgia. More than a podcast.